seems to me in the book of Acts that the word isn't actually Pentecost. And this is actually where that becomes a little bit of a dichotomy and a bit of a pain. But it seems to me that in fact when you said there's prayer and worship, actually prayer and worship is first.
What?
Prayer and worship is first in the book of Acts and Acts 2. And it's out of prayer and worship that then the word is proclaimed. And then you see the response. I think so often we have proclaimed the word not out of prayer and a move of God's Spirit, but perhaps out of, I mean, I'm not going to judge that moment, but I'll look at the fruit. We don't see the Acts 2 fruit. And therefore, I wonder if we kind of missed something beforehand. And so I think the proclamation of the word is very, very important. But what's the fruit of it and what's the foundation of it, I think we're missing those two things. Because I think we do proclaim the word in the American church. But I'm not so sure we're seeing the fruit. And particularly, I'm just another looking at, as evangelicals, we're conservative.
One more question before the break. And
I guess it's a personal question. In light of the scriptures in Acts, and as they gave, it said they was without warrant. And what I see in that is there is no poverty in your giving. Because it took the shape of people gave them, and therefore there was no. That brings me to the question is, needs being met, in your experience, did you feel, once the conviction of giving, rolled over into giving, and you experienced the joy of giving, did you then experience the need to give, to hold on to that joy, and understand that what you were giving didn't even
Well, according to my experience, especially with North German farmers, it's not a problem to give, it's a problem to receive. I don't want to thank anyone for anything, my farmers would say. It's a special, gracious way to receive a gift, a help, if you need it. Because you must respect the respect of the people. And sometimes with gifts and help, the self-respect is hurt. And therefore it's a special grace to receive and not only to give.
So much. Collaborative moments in the first half, and to make this more of a conversation, and Professor Moltmann Jürgen a partner in that conversation. One of the things that he really wants to take home from this gathering is a sense of your stories and your experiences and the wisdom from the work you're doing. So please, as you ask questions or as appropriate, take an opportunity to share More of the autobiographical context of some of your questions too, because I know indeed we'd all like to hear those. We will meet here and until 12, at which point lunch will be served in the room on the opposite end of the downstairs building, buffet lunch, which we could bring back in here. If there's still sunshine, we can take outside and enjoy the garden. We have turned the air conditioning off, so we all might all sort of be sweating in 15 minutes, but we can open the doors and make some adjustments there. So if you don't mind, I'd like to just ask a quick question to get us started. Now that I said let's do a collaborative mode, and I now turn back to ask Professor Moulton the question. But one of the things that I wanted to bring up in response to your beautiful meditation on Christian community is this whole language of sharing and of giving. You probably know that this language has, in some quarters, been co-opted in the American church and recent public debate by certain political elites who love to speak of the idea of sharing inside Christian communities, but don't want Christian communities to speak to the state about the way in which the state needs to participate in sharing. So there's a book called The Tragedy of American Compassion, for example, by a writer named Marvin Alasky, who many consider one of the architects of the President's Faith-Based Initiative. And his vision is that the state needs to relinquish all the provision of goods and services to the congregations. So the state doesn't need to be in the business of providing welfare and providing services, building infrastructure in low-income neighborhoods. That's the business of the church. So we can talk about this language of sharing inside the practices of Christian communities, but let's not have the church speak to the state about providing services. And it seems to me, I mean, we have my friend Stan Reynolds from Mississippi. Some of you have followed the horrendous policies of the new born-again governor of the state of Mississippi, who has essentially eliminated Medicaid for
83,000
of the state's most poor citizens, really sort of, in the spirit of compassionate conservatism. He's trying to eliminate public education. We can't have a serious debate in this country about raising taxes without religious voices coming in and just demonizing the whole notion of redistribution of the wealth. As Christians, we confess not only a God who gives enough, but a God who gives in excess. And yet it seems that in our social practices in the American church, we want to speak of giving not in excess, but giving in a way that is constrained and limited and privileging. And I'm wondering if you can talk a minute about the relation between the church's language of sharing and the church's obligation to the state and its demands on the state to participate and to be involved in that.
The situation in Germany is completely different because we started with a welfare state. And it's not a give and take between rich and poor. It's a question of the rights. I have a right to be supported if I'm sick. I have a right to be supported if I am unemployed. So it's not a giving of alms and charity. That's also necessary, but the fundamental thing, these are human rights. According to the General Declaration of Human Rights, according to our Constitution, and according to the legislation of our state at the moment still. But we are in a transformation of this welfare state because it has become too expensive, and we are running into debts if we go on as we had done it before. So we need, on the one hand, the fulfillment of human rights of unemployed and sick people, and on the other hand, to stimulate more private initiatives. This again is a question of freedom and equality at the same time. But those who are unemployed have a right to be supported by the community, and it's they don't need to be grateful for it. It's their right. And if you put it into the compassion, what is this, compassionate thing, then it's a question of gratefulness and obedience, and on the other hand, of sovereign giving, graciously giving, etc., but no longer a question of the right, the social rights of the people. And I think we must maintain this, at least in Germany, that everybody has a right to work. This is Article 7, I believe, in the General Declaration of Human Rights, written down in San Francisco, in your country, in 1948. And we have then the International Covenants on Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights, also signed by your government. So I think if we want to have social justice, we need to have a better legislation for Medicare and also for the care, for the existence of unemployed people. They have a right to exist, they have a right to live, and okay, this will be my answer to that.
Please follow up on Charles' question in your response. I thought the heart of Charles' question was the situation in which the church needs to speak not simply about sharing in and among itself and so on, but needs to speak to the state.
Yeah.
We are reticent, I think is a modest way of putting it, to speak to the state about justice for the public life.
Right.
Is the church in Germany speaking to the state? Has it in the past and now is doing it another way?
Oh, yeah.
What can you do to help us with the issue of the church's silence, or relative silence, in speaking to the state on issues, especially of economic social justice?
Well, on the one hand, we have the Roman Catholic Church in Germany, and they have this encyclicals on social ethics. They are very good with a criticism of capitalism, for example. If you quote from Quadragesimo Anno, for example, everybody would say, oh, that's Karl Marx, but it was a pope. there's a very good social teaching of the Roman Catholic Church to the state and to the community at large in Germany.
The priest of the Catholic Church then take that social teaching straight into their pulpit and preach it there?
I hope so. At least they have to. They must do it if they are obedient to their church. On the other hand, we have open declarations of the Protestant Church, the Evangelical Church in Germany. These are called Denkschriften, writings for thinking, or what is the translation for a Denkschrift? A memorandum. And so we have a memorandum on the right of work and a memorandum on social justice. Now, what is at stake in Germany is minimum annual income. I remember 40 years ago, my friend Fred Herzog said when the pastor at my church in Durham spoke, took the word in his mouth on minimum annual income, the one of the rich families left the church immediately. This would not be the case in Germany. We are too close to the socialist world. We had been too close to the socialist world, and we had to have a social welfare state after the war. So we have a social market society, an ecological market society, with the stress on on social and ecological. At that point, we are more on the side of equality and less on the side of personal freedom. Well, would be fair to say.
In the most recent issue of the Nutmeg Review that was done here at PBA, Hedgehog Review, the most recent issue.
I think through the big parties, we have a more conservative party, the Christian Democratic Party and the Social Democratic Party, who are pressing for the rights of workers and of sick. And then we have a strong Green Party, which is bringing the environmental questions into the debate. And they have around 10%, 10 sometimes, in some regions, 12 or 15% of the votes. So this is all in public. And then we have the not only private radio and TV stations, but TV stations by the state without advertisement.
So, the European
community engages in this conversation about... Well, we are a little bit overpopulated, you know. It's a big... people living in a small place, so everybody knows everyone, so to speak, and it's not like in this country where you have freedom in space, and sometimes in the Middle West or so, they don't care about what they say in Washington, and an normally percentage of votes in elections in Germany is between 70% and 80%, and not less than 50% like in your country. So there must be a lot of people in your country who don't care about politics. But, you know, in the life of generations, of my generation, generations to come, our personal careers and personal expectations were crossed and cut by political decisions. And therefore, we are all a little bit over-politicized, perhaps. Participate in the debate, and there are a lot of debates between these three parties in the pubs and on the marketplace and between colleagues.
But I'll take my Baptist friend to the pub tomorrow.
Well, this is our situation. So.
Bring your camera.
Yeah.
And also with our legislature, I think that
deep sin that they have, they're cut off from the people. They hang around people like themselves. They don't see their history from there.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there is a any sense in which scarcity and suffering are necessary parts of the community's life, because there's a depiction of the church as those who participate in the martyrdom of Jesus, and pretty much it. And so I'm interested in if there are necessary sense in which we don't experience.
Well, the sense for community is most alive in common suffering. So it's not a community and the wealth of a community, but in a situation of common suffering, people then spontaneously come together and help each other, and mutual help is a response to common suffering and common scarcity, etc. So the humanity of people in Germany after the war, when everything was in ruins and nobody had enough to eat, etc., the feeling for community and mutual help was much stronger than after the restoration of the German economy, etc. We left this type of community. So shared suffering is half suffering, geteilt is Leid, is das Beste. So we should not say it's necessary, but we should not forget the situations in which we had this strong feeling for community in shared suffering. And the joy of life is not only if you are wealthy, but if you are in poverty, you can feel this joy of life in coming together with other people and not sharing what you have, but be together in what you are. It's not only a question of possession or poverty. It's a question of what you are. I visited in Argentina the barrios where very poor people were living, and there were priests of the third world. And they said, we are just preparing for a wonderful fiesta. I thought, in this terrible situation here, in this camp, oh yes, and we were invited, and this was a beautiful fiesta, a great feast of joy. And I said, well, the poor are able to celebrate a feast, the rich have only cocktail parties. And that's about the laughter of the oppressed. yeah.
Willingness to endure injustice in the interest of God's vindication.
You can avoid suffering by being silent and obedient. You go into suffering if you stand up and fight for your right. Then you have to suffer. And that's a better way than to be obedient and let injustice happen to you and then pretend that you by this take up your cross. That's not the way, I think. So believe in Bob Marley, stand up and fight for your right.
On this question of how the church may speak to the state, it seems to me that one of the ways that the church and its language gets privatized is precisely to do with the language that in speaking to the state and speaking about politics. And there may be different stories about how this works, but one story that I've learned is it's precisely in adopting the language of rights that the church fundamentally privatizes its ethos, its sense of justice. And it seems to me that if we're going to talk about must talk about some concepts like action and what kind of rationality is embodied in action. What do you think of the notion of thinking about the rationality of political action in terms of the model of polis? Rather than a model of a state. I know there are problems with this. But in that sense, justice becomes a virtue rather than a matter of rights. And we've had the experience here in our intellectual culture, which the main book about justice by John Rawls constructed the position by ruling out the first order language of religious communities as kind of not the kind of reasons that ought to be accepted in public conversation, such as the conversation might be. And what seems to me that the strength of this, although I know there are problems, talk about the polis, just as a virtue rather than just as right, is that you then adopt a language of rationality, which, at least in a traditional context, has a place for formation, a kind of formation of just people.
Wow.
Rather than saying that, well, we have a just society when people can kind of claim their needs as right, just using a different framework.
Well, it's difficult for me to answer. You always had in this country Christian movements in politics, the civil rights movement, for example, to overcome racism and to get rid of illegal laws and regulations in schools, etc. And as far as I remember, Martin Luther King intended at the end to have a march not only of the oppressed against racism, but of the poor against poverty, a march to Washington. And at that point, I would like to give over my response to you, because you are continuing this legacy of the civil rights movement. At the moment, you have the conservatives in a big and strong political influence on politics. But this is changing. And perhaps in Germany, we don't have so many movements as you have. We have more institutions. we are a little immobile. But you are more man on the move. And
did you have a follow-up with that?
Yeah.
actually, I'm not sure which book it was, God's Long Summer, I don't know the order. And I was talking to a priest in Birmingham, and he gave me, I think, a wonderful summation of what you had done, which is that you look at a specific context and a certain, you named how theology became disordered in reaction to racism. And so this concept of disordered theology seems to be more important than pondering the borders of where the church and the state lie. And that was where I wanted to speak to what you were saying, Jack, because it seems to me that one of the ways that we can go with social analysis of why people's hermeneutics with regard to sexual behavior is so much different than poverty is that one of the forces, I'm not saying exclusively, but one of the forces for reading the Bible that way appears to be that there's a concerted effort not really to privatize religion, but to focus on personal behavior so as to advocate for a limited government, abortion, stem cell research, and gay marriage cost the state nothing if you oppose them. This is all part of a larger force that is meant to steer the way we understand the Bible and the way we develop doctrines. And until we name that, until we walk, you know, perhaps sometimes vulnerable, but until we walk and begin to go that deep into how our context has forced us to read the Bible that way, until we name the disorder in that, and the disorder in our understanding of what God might mean by having a sexual ethic, or what God might mean by having an economic ethic. We're going to be constantly policing the borders and engaging in conversations that in some sense remind us of our own powerlessness.
There's a question over here.
Yeah, I was just about the comments. I want to address the issue of, I think the Gregory is how you, I guess, pastors of middle class communities, I guess, put together a compelling argument for I guess, ushering to encourage their congregations to endure suffering. I find that whenever people talk about enduring suffering willingly, I think it can be very problematic. Not necessarily if you're reading it from the position of being empowered, but if you're on the bottom and you're looking up, I think talking about enduring suffering willingly can be very, very problematic. It's very, very dangerous in the sense that I guess there's different levels of oppression. You have racial oppression, you have class oppression. You also have, there can also be sexual oppression. And like, say for example, I'm a oppressed wife in a household, but I'm hearing from my pastor that I'm supposed to endure suffering when at the end of, and it's some removed distance, I'm supposed to receive some benefit from this. You know, like, I don't know, and I'm not saying that, you know, that we shouldn't encourage sacrifice on behalf of the poor, but I just want to, you know, I guess, throw out that, you know, talking about suffering this way can be very problematic. And one way that I've seen it come out actually in a book recently is, I don't know if you guys have picked up Daniel Bell's, the subtitle was like, The Refusal to Cease Suffering, and he's talking about Latin American liberation movements and I guess the need to oppose those and to encourage those communities to refuse to cease suffering. And I guess I'm saying that all I have to say, it can be very, it's very careful, we have to be very careful when we talk about suffering, because if we're not careful about, you know, if we're talking about, I guess where we're trying to locate that suffering, we can aid in oppression. Mm-hmm. But I guess to kind of take it out of there and kind of make it, I guess, so then in
Well, let me try to answer your question with a differentiation Bonhoeffer made between active suffering and passive suffering. I can suffer passively by just taking it in, and I can suffer actively if I resist. So during the Third Reich, many people, my family too, just covered their head and stopped there to listen and to see and kept silent to survive. While Bonhoeffer went into active resistance and had to suffer for it. And that's active suffering, and this active suffering can be called sometimes redemptive. While passive suffering is good for your survival, sometimes. And I think liberation theologians make the same difference between passive suffering and get people out of the passive suffering into active suffering, because that's meaningful.
Yes, please. And then,
yeah, I think that's a great point. And that's exactly the point at which I'm feeling attention. Because I know that you can use a certain rhetoric of suffering in the service of injustice. And one of the things I found so compelling about Martin Luther King in my home life growing up as a boy in South Carolina was the vision of the kingdom of God that he gave. That was this liberating vision. I remember watching these black and white movies, you know, of people walking down the street and thinking, that's it. That I want to be a part of that. And at the same time, there is, as the book of Acts bears out, a vision of the kingdom of God that includes, in which I, and why I use the word necessary, is Paul, which is a willingness to sort of step into that suffering and to take it, and indeed to sort of somehow validate our ministry by the depth of that suffering, where Paul in Corinthians talks about, okay, you want me to establish my apostleship? Here's how I'll do it. I was beaten. I spent a day and a night in the open sea. I was shipwrecked. This happened to me. 4 times I received it. And so there's a sense in which I'm struggling to find a vocabulary in a theological room to talk about suffering and cruciformity and martyrdom as a necessary part of a massively consumerist, self-oriented church without at the same time beginning to reinforce the very unjust structures that they're ignoring. You know what I mean? So I'm not sure. I can't figure out how to really do it.
Just to add on that, just because I think it's so important that it goes to that Paul not only mentions the suffering in that 2 Corinthians 11 passage, but he also mentions the glory he's experienced. And I think they have to go together because it's the fullness and the glory and the suffering that if they don't go together, you can get what Ambrose talks about, I mean, masochism or just oppressing the oppressed. But if it's Paul says, and on top of that, I experience, you know, this out-of-the-body experience of the third
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's a good image. And Dr. King talked of redemptive suffering, as he did often. It was suffering in service to the building of the kingdom, if you will, that you observe in the streets of Montgomery and other small southern towns. It wasn't making suffering normative, but it was accepting the suffering that comes in the movement flourishing.
Well, that's good. That's not helpful. Because yeah. I think my question is theologically, what is there a sense in which suffering is normative? Mm-hmm. And I'm very much struggling with that question right now.
So, that's all. Good answer. So.
Evangelical mind, and I it's always struck me as full of problems and dangers, as it becomes a requirement of discipleship. Now there are two questions. One is Philippians 2. I think the emphasis is on he became obedient. He did the will of God. He did not conform to the will of society. And by doing the will of God is proclaiming the kingdom of God, healing the sick, and etc. So Christ's suffering was active suffering, not passive suffering. Because of the kingdom of God, he came into this situation to be accused and then crucified. And this is the obedience is the emphasis on it, not to take suffering like earthquakes or destiny or so. And the second point is we have had this famous social philosopher Max Weber, and he wrote a book on Calvinism and capitalism. And the examples are all from the United States of America, from Benjamin Franklin on. He was wrong in view of, historically wrong in view of Calvin, who prevented 3 times a bank to be established in Geneva. So he was against capitalism. And the other examples from
from the Methodist Church, etc. They are wrong, but from Benjamin Franklin on to the success of your business is a sign that you are elected. This was the rationale of Max Weber. And with this he tried to show that the spirit can form business against Karl Marx, who said only business forms the spirit. This was his idea. Whether he is right or wrong is another question. For the Reformation time, he was wrong because all the big capital in the Reformation time, the Fugger and the Lombard, etc., were in Catholic hands and remained in Catholic hands and did not become reformed. And Spain was then exploiting Latin America for gold and silver, etc., all in Catholic hands and not in Puritan hands. But he made this connection between Calvinism, Puritanism, and capitalism, which German journalists like very much whenever they speak about America, they have this Puritanism, capitalism idea. But this is only an historical remark. It's not very important.
As the daughter of a Reformed Church pastor, I have seen my father change a lot over time. And when I was a young girl, he was refusing to pay his income tax in protest of Star Wars. And now that I'm an adult, he voted for George Bush. He would kill me for telling you this.
Yeah.
And as we think about, we're thinking very radically and imaginatively here, and as we think about what the redemption of political structures would mean, what I would like to know is, must we start with assuming that democracy is the best of what we have here on Earth?
Well, it depends on what you understand of democracy. If democracy is a self-government of the people, as Lincoln said in your Gettysburg address, of the people, by the people, for the people, then it's all right. But if it's the organization of corporate America, if I may say so, it's wrong. And at the moment, all the TV stations and the newspapers, they are all in the hands of corporate America. And this is not a self-government of your people. You may tell this to your father, from a Reformed professor to a Reformed pastor.
There is evidence to support that transition. I mean, just recently reported that the profit after inflation adjustment, profits for the corporate America is up 14%, while personal income is down, which would suggest that transition from democracy being for the people to democracy. And there are many other indices.
Yeah. This is a long and complicated story. Many of these Turkish guest workers came first in order to make some money in Germany and then return, buy a house in Anatolia and live. Since 1990, this all of a sudden changed, so they wanted then to stay in Germany. But to stay in Germany meant for them to have a parallel society where they can speak their Turkish language, have their Turkish Quran schools, etc., etc. And this is not good, because this is not an integration. This is a separation then from the society in which they live. So we now demand that whoever lives in Germany or comes to Germany must learn the German language before he gets the German citizenship. In your country, it may be the same with Mexicans coming with a Spanish language, but you must correct me, I don't know very much about it. And then you must learn the Constitution, at least some of the rights of the Constitution. And we try now to have an integration on the terms of German language and the German Constitution, so that the Turkish families who live in Germany know what the rights of citizens in Germany are. Because we have cases of this honorary murders, Ehrenmord in families. So if a Turkish girl goes with a German friend, according to old Anatolian unwritten laws, the father can kill this girl, or the brothers do it. Sometimes the younger brothers, because they cannot then brought to court for it. And this is impossible. A woman in Germany has certain rights which cannot be diminished. So we now have the struggle between the right to have one's own religion and one's own lifestyle, and the common law, which is the same for everyone in Germany. This is not much different from your country. So what do you do with Mexican immigrants? Do they learn English, or do you learn Spanish? And, do you need a common language? Do you need a common constitution? Do you have common schools? Okay, that's perhaps answer. Yeah, all right. Right.
Whereas
yeah.
If your child is automatically a citizen if they're born
okay.
in Germany.
Yeah.
If I'm of Turkish descent, my child is born in Germany, even if I'm great great grandparents have been there since 1990, has to go through a process. They can't automatically, by birth, be a German citizen. Birth, where you're born didn't determine whether you're a German citizen.
Oh, I think I cannot answer that question very well, but these are very practical questions. My first daughter is a teacher in a school. Now there are 20% Turkish children in her class. And the father and the imam said, you must not obey a woman. You are a boy, you are a man. And to the girls, the parents say, you must not take on a bath suit if the class is going to swim. So there are a lot of very practical questions, what is what must be in common and what can be taken as the dignity of difference. These are the questions we have at the moment. And we would like to learn from you how you integrate the people from all over the world.
As long as you can enter into a capitalist economy, you're welcome. That's how we do it. You know, as long as you think you've got something to sell or something to buy or something, some work to do, we'll trade with anybody. That's how Americans have done it.
Yeah, but what are you doing in the school?
Well,
a process too complicated for them to enter into the discussions.
But do you teach in English or? Do you teach in English or in Mexican,
state,
Vietnamese?
I mean, it's a very controversial issue in California. Uh-huh. In Texas, it's not as much of a controversial issue in Tennessee because there's no way for Hispanics to have a political voice that they can express in the need to have.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
It's
okay.
Very difficult to get that done in Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you.